This month, The Spectator becomes the first magazine in history to print 10,000 issues, and we'd like to celebrate with you. Subscribe to The Spectator for 12 weeks for just £12. Plus, we'll send you a bottle of commemorative Spectator gin, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/celebrate.
Hello and greetings from lockdown. Welcome to That's Life, Spectator Life's sideways look at what's left of the world today. I'm Benedict Spence.
And I'm Andy Shaw.
And on this podcast, we'll be poking fun at the people, ideas and events that have popped up in the news over the past few weeks, all whilst bedecked in hazmat suits and remaining at a suitable, sociable distance from one another, which frankly is how all interaction should be conducted in the post-Me Too era. That's right, folks, the plague's back in town. Samuel Pepys' diaries have sold out, and outside Jeremy Corbyn's North London flat, a man with a cart is parading up and down with a bell, chanting, "Bring out your deadweight." Which is pretty poor form from Keir Starmer, but I suppose what else is an ambulance chaser going to do these days? Elsewhere, the rest of the nation has begun working remotely. And the President of the United States has been accused of racism for calling the epidemic the Chinese virus. One can only imagine the fury of the Guardian comment desk when they discover this thing called the Black Death. But aside from all of this, we still have a podcast to do. And our guest for this episode is comedian and political satirist Andrew Doyle, whose fictional character, Detani McGrath, became the number two Twitter account for satirising the woke movement, only narrowly being pipped to the post by the top parody account, a wild, barely believable creation by the name of Jamila Jamil. Andrew has performed stand-up at the Edinburgh Fringe and is a regular contributor to the online publication Spiked Online, a website so contrarian it's actually considering giving COVID-19 its own column. Andrew, it's great to have you with us. How are you surviving lockdown so far?
I'm fine. I'm quite accustomed to being indoors anyway, because that's what I do. I'm a writer, so I stay inside a lot of the time. And I'm finding quite stressful the expectation of having to do one session of exercise per day. That is bothering me. But apart from that, things are okay.
And Andy, what about you? Are you surviving being indoors?
Well, I'm a bit like Andrew, actually. I don't do that much exercise nowadays, but I'm going out every day an hour before the sun goes down. And I've never seen the local woods and parks so busy.
Well, that's good. That's optimistic that, you know, a nation of people who have spent most of their lives inside, very suddenly, the second that there's a pandemic, discovered this thing called exercise. I think that's very optimistic. Now, Andrew, there have been, shall we say, a bit of a dearth of variety in topics in the news recently. But if there was one thing that really stood out for you, what would be the event that has really caught your imagination in the past few weeks?
Well, everyone's been talking about the same things, obviously, but one of the things that I think probably deserved more attention than it got was Parliament's Emergency Powers Bill, which was passed through very, very rapidly because it had cross-party support. And I actually first read about this at the weekend when David Davis actually suggested that there should be some kind of stopgap on the emergency powers, because of course the emergency powers allow the government to isolate anyone suspected of infection, which could of course be absolutely anyone. There's some quite extraordinary powers being granted to Parliament, and whilst I do understand the necessity for emergency powers at a time like this, I also think there should be it should be scrutinised every now and then by Parliament so that it doesn't later become exploited. I think what they're saying now is it has to come back to Parliament every 6 months or so to be reviewed, but it's still quite extraordinary that this has happened and has been cheered on by everyone from the left and the right.
Yeah, there doesn't seem to be a lot of scrutiny, does there?
No.
It is quite interesting that there's been a big discussion about this sort of nudge theory and then the sort of draconian powers. And it does seem that the government has seeded an idea to see what the sort of response will be. And actually the response largely has been people have acted in a very complicit manner and sort of seem to have taken responsibility immensely, very, very quickly.
It's been very odd, hasn't it? It's been odd to hear people who've been decrying Boris Johnson and his team as fascists for so long are now applauding him for taking these draconian measures. It's a weird phenomenon.
I do remember going down to Parliament Square, because I was working nearby at the time when the prorogation of Parliament came in, and there was a big protest there, Stop the Coup. And there must have been about 3,000 people or so, all sort of got picnics out and sat down in Parliament Square. And the police just cordoned it off. They didn't make any attempt to move it at all. And I remember speaking to a bus driver who just gave up, and he just said, well, I'm just sat here on overtime. And then went back to talk to him about half an hour later, and he said, well, they're not going to give us overtime, so I'm going to leave the bus here. And it was just like, Parliament Square was just closed down. The police just let it happen. And you said to people, well, you know, they're going to extend Parliament by about 3 weeks. Oh, it's a coup. It's a fascist coup. It's absolutely terrible. And Paul Mason making fantastic speeches about, you know, about how these are unprecedented times. And yet we are living in genuinely unprecedented times where the state is granting itself enormous amounts of powers. And people just go, oh, well, fair enough.
It does kind of put things into perspective, doesn't it? You know, I mean, with the stop the coup thing, I mean, now we can look at that and think that, well, it absolutely was not a coup by any stretch of the imagination. I don't think the prorogation was wise as it happens, but I don't think it was a coup by any means. And all sorts of things. I'm seeing a lot of sort of chat on social media about how, what with all of the coronavirus epidemic, it will put an end to kind of the excesses of the social justice movement, and people will start to see things in perspective a little bit. I'm not so sure that's going to happen, unfortunately. I hope it does. But I don't think that's going to be the case. I think people are still going to be as... Give it a couple of weeks of isolation, people get back to being their usual mad selves.
But there is something interesting, isn't there, in that everything that we thought was massively important only 3 weeks ago just seems utterly irrelevant now. So
exactly. There's something quite positive about that, in a way.
I think there is.
If it trivialises the stuff that has heretofore been trivial but treated as of utmost importance, then I think that can only be a good thing.
Yeah, wasn't it that half the Guardian journalists and staff backed the opposite... Sorry, who was the journalist?
It was Suzanne Moore.
Moore, wasn't it, who wrote the article. That was a huge, big issue for those people. The most important issue that said whether they should work, if their employer was a good employer, you know, what is right and wrong was being defined around that.
Yeah.
And that just seems now, you look at it and you just think, what on earth were you lot on about? This is utterly bonkers.
Exactly. Although I don't know if the people who signed that letter against Suzanne Moore really have that capacity for self-reflection. You know, I mean, it is important when a group of journalists can effectively bully another member of staff and say that they don't feel safe going into work anymore because of an opinion that someone has, which is clearly not true. I mean, that's a tactic. And that is really serious that's happening in a major publication. But you're right, like, no one cares. No one's talking about it now. And, hopefully they feel really silly. They don't, do they? Let's be honest.
Well, let's sort of reevaluate a few things, like what is being safe?
Right, exactly.
You know, is it not being struck down by a pandemic, or is it, you know...
Is it hearing a nasty opinion? or hearing opinion you don't agree with? Yeah, that's the, you know, they'd weaponise that word safe in a really sinister way, and I don't think it works anymore. I think, for now, I think they'll probably be crying in a few weeks' time about how... I mean, we've already had it. We've had the article in Vice, which talked about how trans operations are being postponed because of coronavirus and how outrageous this is. And you just think, well, they're not going to stop, are they?
I remember reading that at the time, something along the lines of coronavirus has shown that to a lot of people, trans operations aren't important, to which the universal response was, well, no, they're not.
Well, but, it was because they were designated as non-essential.
Yes.
That's the phrase, non-essential. Because non-essential isn't meant to mean we don't think they're important. What it means is they're not life-threatening. You know, that's all it means. It's so weird that, like, even in the midst of all this, and there's all sorts of articles coming out about, who is it, the New Zealand politician talking about how the coronavirus is a gendered issue?
Oh, yes.
And her point was that it mostly affects women because they're more on the front line. Of course, most of the fatalities have been men by quite a long way, but that doesn't matter, does it? I mean, any excuse to turn this into a feminist issue, I think.
It is odd how people are trying to shoehorn their own particular viewpoint. And of course, everyone quite naturally does this, but shoehorn their own particular viewpoint into the coronavirus. I saw a tweet. In fact, I've pretty much stopped looking at Twitter now because it's got really boring.
Yeah, it is boring.
But every now and again, I sort of dip in and have a look, and there was a tweet that somebody was expressing outrage, absolute outrage, that Britain wasn't part of the EU plan to buy ventilators. And I just thought, well, does the EU Commission actually have a factory that can produce ventilators? Are we really, really badly missing out on the fact that somebody in the EU is writing a purchase order right now to somebody, some factory somewhere, probably outside of the EU, to possibly buy some ventilators at a time when everybody in the world is trying to buy ventilators? It's not like we're really missing out, is it? And it was given as an example about how, you know, being outside of the EU is not a catastrophe for us.
I think I saw the same... That was a Twitter thread of different people sort of pushing their own ideas. Everybody from, you know, wanting universal basic income to open borders to closed borders. You know, it's possible somehow to frame whatever your raison d'etre is through the prism of the coronavirus. And then my favourite one was that Liam Gallagher took this opportunity to say, this is why we need to have an Oasis reunion. I think that sort of tickled us all.
That actually strikes me as one of the most sensible ones. I quite like Oasis. But the thing is, though, there is this thing of anything can be hijacked for a political agenda. I mean, now everyone's saying, you know, if only we had socialism, this would be all right. Or doesn't this prove that socialism is the way forward because we've effectively got a kind of short-term socialist state at the moment, you know? Or will this show that we should close borders forevermore? You know, anyone's political bugbear, they can now use this as evidence for it.
Sure.
I mean, even the stuff about Donald Trump referring to it as the Chinese virus, and I've seen all these debates going back and forth as like, well, there's a reason why we don't call it the Spanish flu anymore. Well, we do. We always have. Everyone calls it the Spanish flu and everyone always had this sort of weird revisionism in order to suit the current way of attacking Donald Trump for calling it the Chinese virus. We're all going to suddenly pretend that we never called it the Spanish flu, which we still do. It's this just weird.
Andy, has there been anything that stood out for you in the past few weeks?
Well, it's sort of, I mean, it's all coronavirus and COVID-19. At least it's got two names, so we've got some variety. But it is the speed of the lockdown. And I saw a poll, which I think was published in The Spectator as well, that 93% of people have accepted it and think it's a good thing. 75% of people believe very strongly that it's a good thing. And 17% think it's somewhat a good thing. But it's just it is just the sheer speed of our acceptance that our entire way of life has been radically closed down. And it's entirely understandable. It's you know, we want to stop a pandemic, and it's not just about protecting ourselves, it's about protecting people we love and our workmates and friends and people around us and wider society. And it's exactly the right thing. But it's the speed of adaptation that I think is really fascinating. And in fact, we're going to be reflecting on this. Some of us have actually got nothing else to do but reflect on things. But just reflecting on how quickly this has happened and how quickly people can adapt how they live, how long people can live with it for, because there are real pressures on, you know, people's lives. It's you know, it is a myth that people are just sat at home watching Netflix. Actually, life's become a lot more complicated and a lot harder for people, and people are, you know, juggling so many things, trying to keep life and work and what have you going. But there was a lovely little vignette that I experienced on Sunday. I always go for a walk on a Sunday morning with my father-in-law, and we decided to go for a walk keeping 2 meters apart, and we took our own beer to sit outside the pub that we normally go to, and in front of it there's a big green where the sort of Land Rover club will turn up and have a chat, or some kids will be playing cricket or what have you. And there was a family meeting their mother, and they stood 2 meters apart, and they pretended to give her flowers, and she pretended to smell them and said how lovely they were. And it was just beautiful. It was utterly surreal, but it just showed how quickly sort of people had adapted to this sort of bizarre reality that, you know, in any other circumstances would be like a Monty Python sketch.
Well, maybe that's what the future is, virtual reality. You know, we sit in our little pods and that's what we do. It'll be like the E.M. Forster story, The Machine Stops, where we all have our own little chamber. And we do, that's the only way we interact.
It's funny you mentioned that. Actually, I started reading that as a result of being shut in isolation.
Oh, really?
Yes, I actually did. That's very odd. Great minds thinking alike. But there was one other thing that had really stood out for me in the past few weeks. Less so much one moment, just sort of a coalescing of moments. And that was the response of certain individuals, certain regimes, in terms of the blame game for this pandemic. Now, obviously, we've had people blaming a lack of European solidarity. We've had people blaming Trump for not acting fast enough. We've had people blaming Boris Johnson for not shutting down the country fast enough. But there were three responses that really caught my eye. The first was one that came from a spokesperson for the Chinese Information Ministry, who took to Twitter to suggest that maybe, because there wasn't evidence that the virus didn't start in Wuhan, maybe it had been imported to the country by, say, a hostile power, say maybe the United States, just putting the idea out there. And of course, naturally, that idea ran like wildfire all around the world. It was run by the People's Daily, the English language newspaper, you know, not even trying to hide it, you know, that what they were doing there, the sort of the disinformation campaign. But it runs a lot further than that. Iran, which has had the second worst outbreak, unofficially at the very least, we're not sure about their figures, but it's had a very bad time of it. The Ayatollah, went on television to suggest that maybe it was also the US, but also the Revolutionary Guard Corps have been putting out the idea that maybe it was Israel that is responsible for COVID-19. Their reasoning being the Israeli government said it was working on a vaccine. And so the logic goes, well, they must have already had the disease for them to be working on a vaccine. But at the exact same moment, a preacher who was very high up in Hamas came out and did a sermon last Friday suggesting that maybe COVID-19 had been sent by God, because in his own words, it was disproportionately affecting other people and not Muslims. And I just think it's really staggering that even in a time of, you know, a global emergency such as this, the response of an awful lot of people is not to try to come together to try to, you know, find a common solution to the problem, but is to try to score ideological points, political points, all these sorts of things. And it just struck me as bizarre that that is the default mode of so many people when something like this happens.
I'm surprised there hasn't been more of the kind of the religious interpretation that this is a plague from God because of all the gays. that normally happens, doesn't it? I was expecting more of that.
Any second now.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'll start it.
Titania McGrath may have to start it. So, Andrew, as you may be aware, every time we do this podcast, Andy is putting together a dictionary of sort of bullshit terms that may mean one thing, have come to mean another thing, or have entered sort of common parlance. And I was wondering if there was a term, a word that might, for you, sum up this current phase that we're living through.
Yes, I think the word would be isolation.
Good
this
choice.
Is a word that we're hearing absolutely all the time now. And we're seeing lots of examples of it. And we're seeing lots of people expressing themselves, how they're coping in their isolation. We saw Sam Smith, didn't we, weeping, posting photographs of himself weeping in his multi-million mansion. Poor blighter. Yeah, so I think that's something that we are experiencing. But I'm not going to be cynical about it. Maybe self-isolation is the more pressing word. But can you have a hyphenated one? I don't know how it works with your rules, Andy.
Yeah, I think you can definitely have self-isolation.
Self-isolation. Because this isn't something any of us had really heard of before. And most of the jokes I'm seeing now on Twitter from comedians are relating to the concept of self-isolation. Well, lots of artists and performers are now performing from their kitchens, aren't they?
Yeah.
Over the internet. And I don't want to be cynical about that because I think it's a really positive thing to do. And I think it's a really decent gesture. It's not something I think I could do because I'm too dependent on the audience. I'm too nervous about whether what I'm doing is actually effective or not. And you need the response from the audience to let you know that, to reassure you that it is. And you wouldn't have that in your kitchen, would you? So I think it's something that I really do applaud everyone else who's doing it. But I don't think I could do that. I don't think I'm going to do that.
Well, I think to just reassure Andrew, I think that anyone who's listening to this podcast that actually likes it has to press the like button like loads and loads of times and leave really, really positive reviews, because that would be fantastic.
Okay. Is that the way they do it? That's the version of applause for the online community.
It's a sort of like a bit of a weak lag, but you do get it eventually. So
right, yeah. Okay. All right, yeah. But it does strike me as very interesting of the way that people will cope with having themselves for company, which is something that people seem to be very frightened of. Maybe I've just become quite... I'm just used to it, you know? I'm not a narcissist. I'm just kind of used to being by myself. I don't know what that says.
I think maybe you just like yourself, Andrew, which I think is a really good thing, comfortable with yourself.
I like that idea that the nation is almost universally terrified of having to spend time with themselves because they know exactly the sort of people that they are and they can think of nothing worse.
Well, there's a big danger, isn't there, in this time of introspection and having to actually think about your life and what you're doing and who you are and what sort of person you are. And I think a lot of people don't like that because of some of the conclusions they reach. So I think that
this is taking a very positive turn.
Oh, sorry. I'm just trying to put a philosophical spin on it.
No, it's fair enough. It's fair enough. Andy, do you like that? Do you like that as an idea for self-isolation?
Yeah, no, I also think that people are also, they're not just isolating on their own. A lot of people are isolating with their own family, and they're not really used to that. So I think people are quite often used to the evenings, weekends and holidays, but spending a lot more time together. I'm sure a lot of parents who have now adopted homeschooling have suddenly discovered that they didn't actually learn that much at school, and probably can't remember a lot of what they did learn. So they're probably being shown up by their own kids for being totally ignorant and incapable of actually doing basic maths, knowing the rules of English grammar, and incapable of teaching them a foreign language. So I think there's probably quite a lot of self-learning going on.
I mean, the thing that stood out for me was, of course, Wuhan, the city has been under quarantine for quite a long time, people being forced to isolate with their families there for months at a time. And the stat that shocked me was when the quarantine was finally lifted in Wuhan, is that a record number of people filed for divorce in one day. That's a nice optimistic thing.
Well, again, you see, the cynical part of me does think that a lot of relationships are maintained on the distance that we keep from each other. I think it's that thing of why so many relationships break down when people move in together, because they hadn't realised what it's like to be with someone for so long and for such long periods of time. Yeah, I reckon we could be seeing a lot of divorces coming up.
Well, the government advice was good. I can't remember which journalist asked Boris, I think it was The Sun, wasn't it, who said, what about boyfriend and girlfriend? Can they pop round and see each other? I'm not sure which advisor it was that suggested that they need to make a decision. Either they stay apart or they move in together. So it's a good test, really, for the next 3 weeks or maybe even 3 months. You know, it's like, can you live together? You know, if you can get through this, then it's going to be a really good marriage. So we might see record marriages as well as divorces.
Well, there was a tweet, but Shappy Korsandi put a tweet out making the point that, you know, spare a thought for the people who've been living a double life and they've got to choose which partner to isolate with.
I think it's families.
Well, I think it's a very good point. I mean, this could expose the bigamists.
Andy, do you have your own word to add to the dictionary this week?
Well, mine is convidiate, which I think was coined last Sunday in response to lots of people deciding that before they have to lock themselves in with their kids and their which partner they've chosen to be with, that they'd spend the last Sunday that they've got either in the park or the last evening in a pub or at the seaside. This coin, I think, was turned around that of these are the, you know, convidiates. Of course, a week before or 10 days before, they were the sort of loo roll hoarders and the people raiding Aldi and Costco with their trolleys, just filling them full. And, you know, it's right to sort of pour a bit of scorn on people who aren't making, you know, being sensible or are acting in a particularly selfish way. But I think we're going to see the real convidiates as we emerge from this, and then people start to make sense of it and try and draw their own conclusions. So people will add in their own or use this to justify their own particular point of view. So you can very easily see it that, I mean, the railways are effectively nationalised now, which, you know, very few people have actually commented on that. Poor Jeremy Corbyn, he must be absolutely sick to the stomach because the government's done pretty much just done the Labour programme in about a week. But, you know, as we emerge from this, people are going to try and draw these, you know, really bizarre conclusions. we're seeing early signs of it already. I saw, in fact, I'm trying to buy as many newspapers as I can, and I have to then spray them with antibacterial and put on the gloves to read them. I should just stick to things online. But George Monbiot wrote, "The planet has multiple morbidities, some of which will make this coronavirus look, by comparison, easy to treat. One above all others has come to obsess me in recent years. How will we feed ourselves? Fights over toilet paper are ugly enough. I hope we never have to witness fights over food, but it's becoming difficult to see how we will avoid them." Oh, my God. I think we're going to see a lot more of that. You know, this was, you know, we got out of this one lightly. Oh, my God, humans are a disease on the earth, and the earth needs to, you know, get its own back. So I think the real convidiates we're going to see as we come out of this, not the people, having a last pint or taking a few too many toilet rolls.
I mean, he loves to catastrophize, though, doesn't he?
Well, I was going to say, it's interesting that you touched upon George Monbiot, because I was going to throw in just a little phrase of my own. And that is, of course, rewilding. Because, of course, ever since the lockdowns, there's been a lot less pollution, and there's been lots of people sharing images on social media, dolphins returning to the Venice Lagoon for the first time in hundreds of years, wild boars being seen walking through the streets of Barcelona with nobody to, you know, to stop them. And of course, this has spawned something of its own meme culture, which is lots of people sharing, you know, pictures of all sorts of animals, ranging from Bengal tigers in Bradford all the way to dinosaurs in Hyde Park. The idea that, oh, look at all this wildlife that's coming back now that humans aren't here to ruin everything. And of course, good old Extinction Rebellion didn't quite see that it was meant to be a joke. One Twitter account, which has come out and said that it was a spoof Twitter account, make of that what you will, but one Extinction Rebellion Twitter account boldly claimed that perhaps humans were the disease and that coronavirus was Mother Nature's response to sort of, you know, readdress the balance. That was something that stood out to me, rewilding this idea of, you know, that sort of environmental doom, that now actually we're beginning to see what that would involve. And I don't think people are going to like it very much, Andy. I think you're right. They may well be the Covidiots.
I think, well, I've just got a question. At the beginning of that, you said Bengal tigers in Bradford. No one's really suggested that one, have they?
Lots of people have suggested lots of things. My favourite ones have been the dinosaurs, though. And there was also the, do you know those dinosaur suits that you can get? Mm-hmm. Somebody was found, I think, walking through Valencia or something when the city was on lockdown, dressed in a T-Rex suit on the idea that it would give him some sort of protection. And people were filming it as he was walking through the streets. So, you know, this random man walking through the streets of a Spanish city dressed as a T-Rex.
Does rewilding apply to human beings as well? I mean, are we all expected to get back to nature? Because none of us are going to be able to get haircuts and things like that. We're going to start looking very feral, I think. And if it does come to the point where people are scrapping over food, then that is, I suppose it will be a kind of...
Well, no, I think you're right. We can't have haircuts and people can't see... But I've decided to adopt the Submariner look. So, you know, when men are just, you know, trapped in a tin can under sea, they all grow these great big bushy beards. So I think men should go for the just let the beards grow. Possibly shave your head, because, you know, anyone in your family who tells you that, oh, they used to cut a bit of hair when they were younger, do not trust them. Do not trust them. That will not end well. It'll be a total disaster. So you might as well just shave your head. And I think for women, possibly, you know, just forget about the hairdressers and just cover your head in a scarf. And in fact, it's been pioneered in Iran. I mean, people haven't really reported on it much, but women in Iran have been taking precautionary measures for the coronavirus for years and wearing face masks, in fact, full face veils. And covered hair. So I think they've been preparing for this for quite some time, and maybe, you know, some form of antibacterial modesty dressing might be appropriate for women in this country.
Well, guys, time is short and we need to flatten the curve. So we always finish with the individuals who have really stood out for us all in the past few weeks. So, Andrew, I was wondering if you could give us the person, the individual who has really embodied the past few months for you.
Madonna.
Some context will be needed there.
Yeah, context will be needed. I think of all these videos that have been posted by celebrities in their isolation, hers have been the most unhinged, I think. I mean, there was one where she's in a bath with rose petals on, musing, well, some very sort of solemn music is playing in the background, musing on how COVID-19 is no respecter of persons. It doesn't matter if you're famous or wealthy, it will come after you. It was the most bizarre kind of philosophical thing that you've ever seen. And then there was another video where she was clearly drunk or inebriated somehow, singing a new version of Vogue, where she changed the lyrics to be about how there's no more pasta left, so we have to eat fried fish instead. and because she's had so much plastic surgery, people didn't realize it was her. They thought it was like a bad, maybe even a bad drag queen pretending to be her. And so I think if it does drive these sort of very, very pampered celebrities insane, then it might have been worth it.
Sorry, did you say fried fish?
She's singing about how there's no more pasta, so we have to eat fried fish instead. I mean, check it out.
It's a funny leap, isn't it? It's a great leap, that. I mean, you might go for tinned mackerel.
Not tin Madonna.
Sardines, but not fried fish.
It's like, not Madonna. No. Madonna doesn't have tinned anything. No. No way.
I'm looking forward to this next experimental Madonna album. This is all just about fried foodstuffs.
Maybe that's what this is. She's probably just trolling everyone. I mean, she might well be. I mean, everyone's sharing her videos, so, you know, it works. And here we are talking about it.
And of course, there was that video that went around of all of those celebrities singing Imagine. And
yes,
that went down just about as well as the Madonna videos, didn't it? Oh.
I think the Madonna videos were funnier. The Imagine videos were tragic.
Yes.
Really, you know.
Pitiful. Pitiful.
Andy, do you have an individual who you would like to raise as the physical embodiment of the post-lockdown period?
Well, there is no one greater than the nurse. Just by the way, I'm saying this, my wife is a nurse, and it's amazing watching her superpowers in action, because she's got a lanyard with NHS around it and, you know, a little ID tag, and she's just like superhuman now. It's like the supermarket clears for you know, there's an hour when everyone else is shunted out of the way and the nurses can just do what they like.
Like Moses parting the Red Sea, sort of.
It's absolutely fantastic. I feel like I know people have said key workers and there's delivery drivers and, you know, shelf stackers and everybody else. It's like all the sort of power relationships in society have turned upside down, which is really, really interesting. So the people who actually do work, like keep the sewage system going or keep the telecoms network working, or I think we used to call them the working class, are actually doing all the work. And then all the office workers and the managers and everybody else are all sort of at home being serviced by all these people and absolutely desperate that, you know, the banking system and the shelves are going to get stacked and all that stuff all carries on. So I think that's really, really interesting. But the nurse is just absolute superhuman. And it's slightly bizarre, you know, and I know quite a few people in the medical profession. There are some people who find it slightly surreal that they are treated as heroes when nothing quite has happened yet. It's almost like, you know, everyone's about to go over the top. And the general comes around and gives the medals for bravery before anyone's, you know, done anything quite yet. Anyway, in the meantime, I'm just going to enjoy the fact that she's got total superpowers and she's going to get applauded in the street when she walks down with a lanyard and she can get the shopping done. So hats off to the nurses.
Nicely done. Anyway, chaps, it's been a real pleasure to catch up with you both, to have you both here. Andrew, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
Andy? I hope you'll be keeping well, and please do pass on our regards to your wife, who is a hero working on the front line of the NHS.
Thank you.
You can follow Andrew on Twitter at AndrewDoyle_com. Or if you're really bored, you can also follow us on Twitter as well. That's at AndyShaw1 and at Benedict Spence. We do hope that you're keeping safe at this time, and hopefully you've enjoyed this podcast. Please do remember to leave us a review on iTunes if you get the chance. And please do tune in and join us next time on the next edition of That's Life. Thank you.